As a writer, I think, and even as a researcher, I think all I'm trying to do is to tap into some kind of truth, share it with others, and see who will meet me in the middle.
Welcome back to TBR. This week, we head to New York City to connect with Inma Naima Zanagura. Inma is a writer, an academic, a creative, and so much more. And before discovering running, she was a professional basketball player. Her work and writing explores movement, dance, displacement, and so much more. In this conversation, we trace her journey through movement, discuss projects close to her heart, and why it's important to keep that beginner's mindset. Let's get into the interview. Inma, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really excited to be connecting with you for the first time, to be learning about you, your story, your perspective on this thing we call running. We were connected by our mutual friend, former guest and former interviewer on the podcast, Tilly. Shout out to Tilly. And I'm really excited to be having this conversation with you. We're recording just after Thanksgiving weekend, but a few weeks ago, you did a bit of a long run in New York, the New York Marathon. How's that?
Yeah, man. Well, thank you for having me. Thank you so much. I was trying to remember this morning. Tilly doesn't know this. You don't know this. But the first time I met both of you was because I Googled Tilly. So we were connected through a friend to work on a project, which will come as an answer to the question. And I Googled her and I wanted to know who I was going to work with. So I saw that she had a podcast episode and it was on your podcast. And so I got to know your podcast through that. And then I got to know her before I met her. And so, this is a lovely, full circle moment that now I'm speaking with you. So anyway, this is all to say thank you. Shout out to Tilly, as you said, for connecting us too. So me and Tilly got connected because Salomon wanted to do some content and promotion around road running. I run with this group in New York City. This is where I'm based, called Motive New York, who is with Salomon. And so they thought it would be great to have some content around the New York City Marathon. And I'd never done a road marathon before. My background, I don't know if I could call it that, because I just started running 6 years ago. I used to be a basketball player, but my background in running anyway is more of a trail running scene situation. So we thought that'd be so fun, like road running or road marathon rookie. Live in New York City, super embedded in the running culture already. Let's sign up for this marathon and see how you do. So that's kind of how it came about. And as you said, it happened a few weeks ago. I'm still processing the experience, still metabolizing all the elements that went into it. What with the Salomon meeting Tilly, which was its own event because she's amazing. And we had awesome conversations around running and around the city. And then of course, I don't know, for me, it was a very special moment to sort of solidify the fact that I do run with the group now. Like, we are a team, right? And we have a creative team behind it too, that is part of Motive, who are also runners. And so it just felt like we were bonding through so many dimensions of who we are and what we bring to the table. And I felt super, super connected to them. And that was super cool.
I love that word you use, metabolizing it. I think that's really interesting. And I think a lot of people, especially when they run their first road marathon, particularly a major as well, one of the scale and iconography of New York, I imagine it takes a bit of time to kind of unpick that. And that's the sense I get of you just from reading about you online and obviously through social media and stuff, which is obviously only ever one facet of an individual, is that you strike me as someone who thinks deeply on movement and has, a considered kind of perspective on it, but it's interesting that thing you say of running as a group. Previously to that, with your kind of background in running, had it been more of a sort of solo thing for you and more of a solo kind of pursuit when you'd first sort of experienced it 6 years ago?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think it's a pretty common experience when people start running to see it as a space where you go to escape the world rather than become, you know, more engaged with the world, which has very much been my, I don't want to say progression, because it ebbs and flows. And I'm sure like it continues to be both of those things for me. But certainly there's been a learning process in terms of what running can give me, me as a person in a community or in various communities. And that is something that has been a delight to come to know. But certainly at the beginning, I was doing my 20 minute runs around the block, just putting my music on, just wanting to be elsewhere kind of thing. And there's, you know, that has its own beauty and its own value. And I like to have that as a resource if I ever want to do it again. But right now I continue to be astonished at how much I can connect with everybody else through running, especially running in a city where there's like the population density is so high that like there's 50 runners just in my block. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's a great way to get to know people, to get to know your surroundings. And yeah, I very much consider myself still a rookie and all of that, and very much enjoying everything that I'm learning along the way.
Why do you consider yourself a rookie still? I feel like you've done a marathon like that. I feel like,
yeah, I'm 100% not a rookie. Like my teammates give me a lot of crap for this. Like, yo, stop. And I like beginner's mindset. I think it opens me up to experiencing what's in the present with new eyes. If I can manage myself to actually put my mind in that space. Not always. I mean, of course, I don't succeed at this every time. But the story I try to tell myself is that I'm still new at this, that I'm still trying to figure it out. And I'm going to carry on with this story for as long as I can. I'm going to be 50 like, I wonder what this running thing is about.
Oh, I love that. I love that expression, the beginner's mindset, and keeping hold of that, of trying to keep that at the forefront of one's mind. I think that's a really interesting idea. And I'm just sort of flipping it ever so slightly. I'm recently kind of discovering visual storytelling and photography at the moment. And there is this real hunger in me to like feel like I need to have like mastered it immediately, rather than seeing it from that perspective that you're talking about, of like each day is a new discovery. Like, and there's this feeling of like, oh man, I wish I could have this thing to do that thing. Or, oh gosh, if only I had XYZ, or I'd done this, and this, then I'd be able to achieve the result that I'm after. And I feel like sometimes, I feel like with running, I often need to remind myself of that as well, of the process, of the kind of stepping stones one has to go on. And I just think that's really lovely of you articulating that. But do you have times where you have those similar thoughts that I was just saying for your running, where you feel like, oh God, if only I could just shave 2 minutes off my 5K PB?
All the time. They might be antagonistic feelings or mindsets, but you know, if you can just lace up your shoes and try to like hold them both at the same time, then you're onto something. And I don't know. I'm very competitive. Like, I beginner's mindset, yes, but if I put a bib on, trust me, I want to shave off those minutes, or I want to place, you know, whatever in the top, whatever. I'm not sure how to not sound like I'm contradicting myself when I say that both of those are true, but that's kind of how it is. But I think there's something very beautiful in studying something new and just like witnessing your process and like these mechanisms that we deploy to like actually learn something for the first time. I think like one of the things that I like try to do is to implement that. Like if I learn it, for example, so I had back surgery almost 3 years ago now, and I started swimming as you know, as we do when we get back surgery. And the process of learning how to swim laps, like not even the biomechanics, like the discipline or even the cardio exercise, just the process of going into a space that I'm that's unfamiliar to me and starting from zero, especially because it's an embodied thing, right? But like just that alone has made me such a better runner. And I wonder if like you're finding some kind of parallel. Not that everything needs to be connected to running, but like how have you been experiencing this like beginner's mindset with like photography and audiovisual storytelling and stuff?
It's very much how you've already kind of articulated that thing of reminding oneself that there is opportunity for discovery within every step of the process, rather than wishing that the results that you are producing are the ones that you have in your mind, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, say if you see something, it's like, oh, I'd like to recreate that. Okay, I've had a stab at it, but it doesn't look like how I saw it in my head. And then by that definition, I feel like I've failed. But actually, those incremental steps of figuring out what those things were that you had to tweak or you had to manipulate or the steps that you had to learn, you've still accumulated some experience and you have stepped further towards your goal. And it's very easy to articulate this and try and sound all like, you know, highfalutin in a podcast conversation. Sometimes it's just frustrating and annoying. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, and it's very easy to zoom out in the wide and be like, you know, there is, you know, there's learning here. Sometimes I swear like a trooper and I'm deeply frustrated. But it's a constant kind of reminding act to just say to oneself, okay, you've only started this in a very relative short period of time. Be kind to yourself and reflect on what you have learned and use that as a foundation to just stay hungry and keep learning. And I do kind of want to apply that to my running a little bit as well, but I'm mindful that this is your podcast, not mine. And I feel like I'm talking a little bit too much about myself here. And I'd love to know a little bit more about you and particularly your entry into movement. Cause you mentioned it then earlier that you used to be a professional basketball player. Was that your beginning journey within sport and movement? Was it basketball? Was that your first kind of love? Or was there anything before that? Like, let's go back to sort of chapter one for Inma, for your kind of journey to movement.
Chapter one. Wow. Yeah, basketball was definitely the thing ever since I was very little. I think I started when I was 7, which by today's standards is not very little because kids start very early. But I started when I was 7. And I played for 15 years. I mean, it was my thing. Yeah. I mean, a lot happened in the interim, but yeah, one thing I have not mentioned is that I'm from Spain, so born and raised in Mallorca. And there's actually like a big sports culture, I would say, like from the outside looking in. I actually went for what would be the equivalent of boarding school. So I entered at age 13 to the sports academy. That's a better way to put it. Sports academy where we practice 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, and go to school. And I did that for 4 years. And then I came to the United States in 2011 with a basketball scholarship and played a lot of national team competitions also around those ages. So it was a lot of basketball for many, many years. And that was the beginning. I definitely look back and see how so many of those things that, so many of the things that I loved about basketball in here in running also, and some others not, but it's cool to think of myself as a person who didn't like change sports, who just changed the way they move. And who found, I don't know if passion, but like who found a solid foundation to her joy and discipline in different sports, but like kind of in the same way. I don't know. It's kind of, I'm still workshopping that idea. But I like the chapters too. That was just chapter one, and now it's a different chapter, same book kind of thing.
I love that. I mean, have you seen, I mean, I know you said you're only workshopping the idea, but have there been any kind of crossovers where you can see that kind of connective tissue between the two practices?
Connective tissue. Yes, actually. And I think this every single Monday. So Monday is the day that we We have a strength and mobility class together with Motive. This is kind of where we see each other. Like we run like sporadically, but our Monday nights we go to class and we get into this tiny studio. It's a bunch of us always. We all just come after a crazy day because we're all busy people in New York. 6:30 p.m. We enter the studio, lights dimmed, Drake on or DMX on, and we just like swing those kettlebells like our lives depend on it. And I get the same amount of excited every single time, and it gives me flashbacks to when I loved basketball because I loved my teammates. I just wanted to hang out with them. And I don't know, this didn't last for my entire career, unfortunately. But when I was like really young, like 12 to 15, I just wanted to go practice because I could see my teammates and we could talk. And on my way to practice, I would get these butterflies, and I get the same feeling at age 30 before I meet with them. And like, that always reminds me that like nothing, well, most of the things that I love about sports have to do with who I do it with, period.
Love that. It's totally agree. The camaraderie will always trump like overcome the suffering. Like case in point, today we're talking on a Tuesday in England. In the UK, a lot of clubs meet for Track Tuesdays, and we are in the sort of midst of our winter at the moment, where the sun's going to be going down. You may even see the remnants of it disappearing during the course of this conversation. And we had a beautiful day here earlier this morning. I was free this morning, and the temptation was to get out and do the workout solo in the sunshine and get ahead of the day. But the sort of the FOMO of not being at the track, which I'll be going to after we have this conversation, and seeing those people, even though it'll be pitch black, the track will probably be iced over. We'll probably be slipping around doing our 400s, but it's that feeling of hanging out, the shared camaraderie, the kind of like half broken conversations in the recoveries that I kind of live for more than the actual workout itself. So I can totally kind of chime with that. And I also love the sound of that Motive strength class, because I don't know about you, I hate strength and conditioning. So I need some like pounding music. I need some like good people to get me in. But do you think you're like background in sort of professional basketball and like, I don't know, I imagine S&C was probably fundamental to your career as a professional basketball player. Does that make it easier for you, the strength stuff?
Totally. I mean, I think I'm a rare one in that regard. I love strength and conditioning. Like I love the gym. So I usually do that on Mondays, and then another day of the week I go to my gym down the street and do the same thing. And I don't get as excited because it's just me. But I usually put the same music on and like same kettlebell, same weight, same workout. And I love it. I mean, I really enjoy that space. But I do think that has to do with the fact that I've been going to gyms since I was, you know, 12. And it's a space where I find a lot of like empowerment, if that makes sense. It sounds a little weird, but there's always people there. So I don't know, like I really enjoy when I see somebody moving in a way that you can tell they love moving in that way, and that they're getting something out of it. And I find that creates a space of like kind of witnessing somebody doing something that they feel good doing. And I like that. I don't think everybody thinks of the gym as in that way, but I do. And so I kind of get a little bit of leverage too, just from what anybody else is also doing. Not everybody that I see at the gym, but the folks I see are there at like 7 a.m. So like, you know, like,
yeah, I get what you mean. The individuals your eye is kind of drawn to. And I love that. I love that expression of, you know, bearing witness to someone finding kind of joy in a movement that they.
Strength.
Yeah, it's really lovely. And I feel like that kind of illustrates the other string to your bow as a kind of as a PhD candidate, as a writer, someone who can articulate kind of concepts such as that you just were then in a kind of wonderful and beautiful way. I mean, one story in particular that I would love to touch on that you were kind of involved with, I was just watching the trailer before we jumped on this call, is the Running Home film that you were part of. Can you kind of, I don't want to do a sort of rough kind of telling of it. I'd love for you to share that story and maybe tell us a little bit about what it was like for you being involved in that that film that I can only imagine was incredibly a personal experience for you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for asking about that. Also for like doing research and stuff. That's very lovely of you. Yeah. You know, that's really not a film I was a part of. Well, it really I'll tell you how I got into the running part later on, but like the film part, once I had decided that I would do that marathon, it was a marathon distance kind of thing, in the desert. I had a friend at the time who was a videographer, and I was like, yo, you want to come with me? You've been talking about wanting to make a trip or wanting to like film different things. So why don't you just come with me and get a little bit of footage? We'll have a little souvenir when we get home. You know, it was like a very small thing, but it was very much my idea. Like, you know, like it wasn't like anybody was like, oh, your story is amazing, we want to produce it. I was like, I like video. I'm going to do this thing. Let's film. But then she was a real trooper and a real hard worker and very talented filmmaker. And so she was like, maybe let's do something a little bit more formal around it. And so that's how it came about. But the trip itself came through me basically after my basketball career, which ended with a sort of a psychological burnout, I would say. So, and I know this is not the question you're asking me, but like, it's important to say that at the moment that I decided to do that run, I was grappling with a lot of emotional and psychological questions around who I was and what I was doing. Because my life since I was 12 had been projected to finish at professional basketball. And once I got there, I think by now this is a classic story. Once I got there, it wasn't what I wanted it to be. It wasn't what I expected it to be. And it was very difficult for me to grapple with, well, then what I'm like, then what? And so I was in this liminal space that I think was also a space of openness and of maybe beginner's mind in a way, beginner at life. I was 23. And I didn't have a clear plan at all. But I had started trail running a little bit, and I knew I really enjoyed it. And I was already showing signs of like some kind of capacity for endurance, or aptitude for endurance. And I did want to challenge myself, because as an athlete, that's always been part of what makes me happy. And then also add to that the fact that I started asking questions about where I come from. So I've always known that I'm adopted. I'm adopted by a Spanish family, but I didn't know where from. I didn't know where my biological family was from, and it never occurred to me to ask. Or if it did, I sort of eluded the question. And that seemed like the right time to ask. Like, if I need to know where I'm going next, I should probably know where I come from. And so I discovered that my biological mom was from the Western Sahara, which used to be a Spanish colony. And there's the connection. And then it became the Western Sahara. And as soon as it sort of tried to gain its independence, it was then invaded by Morocco. And so it is currently under occupation, which means that all the Sahrawis who live there had to either flee to refugee camps or stay under occupation, basically, or become refugees in other countries. And a few of them came to Spain. And my mom was among them, my mom and her family. And I didn't know that story for the longest time. And once I found out about all of this, I had a very strong sense that I needed to reconnect with that story, with that part of where I come from. And I was just Googling stuff, and I just came upon the fact that there's a thing called the Sahara Marathon that happens every year, and that is organized by the refugees that live on the border of the Western Sahara with Algeria. And they have, I think, 5 refugee camps, and the marathon connects 3 of them. And I thought it was an extraordinarily beautiful idea, even though the context of it is not beautiful at all. But as soon as I saw it, I knew I had to sign up. And so I signed up and started training for what would become my first marathon. And yeah, and then told you already the story of how I just asked this videographer friend of mine to come with me and make a film. And it turned out to be a beautiful film. I love it to this day. Like, sometimes you create something that's very important to you, and next year you're like, whoa, who was that? I don't like that. I can't even look at it. For me, it's really the opposite. I love the film. She did an amazing job. And I think it tells a very beautiful story. So yeah.
And what's been your, just because you remember we were talking earlier about the, you're still kind of metabolizing the New York Marathon. What's been your experience post running that Sahara Marathon and kind of metabolizing that experience and connecting to your identity and where you're from? Like, how has that impacted kind of your perspective as someone who writes, who writes kind of papers and a PhD candidate? How is that, I suppose, how has it filtered into your work as well and your practice?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I could take that question so many places, but the most honest thing to say is that that film, I would not have been able to articulate this at the time. That film was a way for me to reach out to the world with a new truth about myself and hoping that somebody would grab my hand and be like, we see this and it matters. And the way that this movie has connected me to other Sahrawis in the diaspora, something I could not have anticipated, something I didn't know was what I was looking for, has very much been the most beautiful and most profoundly transformative result of that process. And as you're saying, as a writer, I think, and even as a researcher, I think all I'm trying to do is to tap into some kind of truth, share it with others, and see who will meet me in the middle. And that's a very potent force, I think. And I do think that it creates some kind of magic where, like, the people that are meant to find you will find you. And so I think one of the reasons why it's impossible for me not to love this movie and this project is because of the people that it's connected me to. And specifically, there have been a few, or a bunch, really, a bunch of, like, Sahrawi women who live in either Spain or somewhere else in the diaspora who are, like, just strong feminist anti-colonialist women who are doing this work day in and day out, who have seen the movie and have told me, we think what you're doing is incredible. We love to see a Sahrawi woman just, like, go out and claim her identity and do this, not just cool shit, but, like, authentic shit for herself. And the fact that they saw the power in that, like, I didn't have to do anything other than be myself and, like, share it. And it mattered to them, and they wanted to in turn hang out with me. You know, and it was like, it sounds silly, but it's like, oh, now that makes you want to hang out with me. And I value that a lot, because I definitely want to hang out with you. And it's been super inspiring to like meet them and see what they do and how they see, like, decolonial work as well. So yeah.
And thank you for just articulating that so brilliantly and eloquently. And I'm always mindful that sense of, like, maybe people listening who maybe heard some of the stuff you've been talking about, and, like, I the people who are maybe too scared to raise their hands and ask what they may perceive as, like, a stupid question. But when you say the diaspora, because I'm looking at the Instagram post now on another screen, the diasporic predicament. What does that, how would you define that to someone who's maybe heard that word and you talking about them? What does that sort of, what's the simplest definition for that, for people to get sort of purchase on what it is you're kind of talking about?
Right. So I think the original people about whom that word was, so, like, the original diaspora, I think it's the Jewish diaspora, people who historically didn't have a land of their own. But especially since colonial and anti-colonial or post-colonial times, and also like very tied to the history of slavery as well. A diaspora is basically a group of people who have been removed from their land. This is the most common use today. The Black diaspora, for example, comprises people all over the world because Black people are everywhere. And not everybody that's Black and not living in Africa would identify probably as diasporic because Black people have been for generations upon generations in many other places outside of Africa for one reason or another. But I think there is a strategic political or even social use of that word that can create something powerful in certain situations, especially I think, or I think this is the case for Sahrawi people, because for us to say that we are diasporic people means that we still think of ourselves as, tied to our land, and we think of our existence outside of that land, maybe as a bracket. Before the land that is rightfully our own will be free. The largest diaspora of the in the world is the Palestinian diaspora, I believe. So yeah, that's basically what it means, if that makes sense.
It does, and thank you for articulating that so wonderfully. I'm always just mindful of people. Yeah, like I always find myself, that thing of like, there's never a stupid question, and always feel like you should raise your hand to like get a better sense of that. And I think you put that in such an easy to understand way, and articulate it from obviously from your own kind of personal experience of that extraordinary film. And can people watch that film? Is there a link where people can find it and they can view it?
Yeah, it's on YouTube for free. Yeah, sorry, Vimeo. It's on Vimeo. It's for free. I can send you the link. If you have show notes, you can put it there. But it's also on my Instagram bio.
Well, we'll absolutely make sure that we link it in the show notes so that people can watch the film. I'm curious, just going back to your, and still keeping within that kind of ballpark of PhD and academia, because there was another conversation that we had on the podcast a couple of about a month or so ago, and it was in conversation with three or four individuals, one of whom was also an academic, a PhD student, the wonderful Sarah Ackland, who was talking about taking up space as a woman running alone at night. And she was just wonderfully brilliant and articulate about that subject and connected to her own personal kind of experience of running. I'm curious for you as a runner, still as a beginner. I know you're at the beginning of your journey. But are you formulating kind of any writing on running? Are there any particular kind of subjects connected to running that you're working on at the moment that we can maybe read? I don't know. It might be from a year from now, 5 years from now. I don't want to put any pressure on you.
No, sorry, I love that question. Love that question. I struggle with this obsession with trying to connect everything to running. So that's something I both embrace and push against sometimes, because I refuse to buy into like this very tempting idea that something will not have meaning for me unless it is in some ways tied to or beneficial to my running. And this is not to say that I want to compartmentalize my life, but to say that the way that running has been useful for me outside of running itself is to just see other domains of life through the lenses of running, which perhaps sounds like the same thing to people outside my brain, but to me, you can do that whether you run or you don't. You can do that if you're injured. You can do that if you decide to not run anymore, right? And there's still something that I'm learning every time that I go out on a run, that can help me see the world in a slightly different way. And I think as a PhD student, maybe like more importantly, this is good for me because running is an embodied act, and it gives you lessons that evade words sometimes, right? Like, there's certain things that you can only learn through the body, and it is those things that I want to inform how I move about the world, kind of, sort of. I write about these in all kinds of forms. I just recently decided that I will start a newsletter that will yeah, that will kind of form a mosaic of how I connect different things that I read. Like I read a lot of critical theory for my research. I read a lot of history of dance and performance studies for my research. And all of those things have connections that seem to only make sense in my brain. But I don't think that's true. And I have a very beautiful model for this, who was also in your podcast, who just came out with a book by Duke University Press and their series on praxis, which I was obsessed with even before they had one on running. I think the author's name is Lindsay
Freeman.
Freeman, yeah. Who is absolutely brilliant and who like out of the blue gives me my book that I was reading, and I was like, how did I not write this before? It was painful. But I'm saying it was a beautiful model because of the way. So she's a sociologist, I believe. She very much has the academic background, but she is so good at like distilling the pragmatic lessons of what we read in critical theory and applying them to her daily practice of running, right? And as soon as I saw that that can be done, I was like, that makes so much sense. So now I'm like reading, like I'm very, very deep into like this rabbit hole of these performance studies author, Andrea Lepecki, who writes a lot about dance and dancing and what the body of the dancer does for society. And so one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is like, what is the figure of the running doing for us as a society? And it's these kinds of questions that sort of merge something I love to do, like running, my practice, and the ways I like to ask questions through the academic register, and poetic register as well. And I just want to bundle all of that together and just like have little write-ups and share them with my friends. And so, yeah, I'll start a newsletter, basically. This is a plug. This is all just a plug because I want people to read that.
Love
but
it.
There's no end inside. I'm very excited about the fact that I'm starting to realize that people want to read that stuff. You know, like people don't want like lack of complexity. People don't want lack of nuance. People like to ask deep questions and to read people think out loud in that way. So you got to give the people what they want.
100%.
I volunteer myself as tribute.
Oh, we finally got a Hunger Games reference in. I've been waiting desperately on the podcast. First off, I feel like you and Lindsay would be that conversation. I would love to just be a fly on the wall to bear witness to that, because I feel like the two of you with your kind of collective incredible academia brain wondery and wizardry would have an incredible discourse about all manner of things. Shout out to Lindsay. That's another incredible perspective on the sport that we love. And I think you're right. I think people are, and it feels even more so now as bigger swathes of people move into running, kind of the post-COVID kind of peak thing has brought a lot of new people into the sport as well. And there's more perspectives to be had. And I think people are always curious to see what it means to other individuals and how other individuals kind of perceive it. I'm interested in one thing you were talking about, though, is this idea of distillation, because I imagine when you're dealing with such big, well, I can only imagine when you're dealing with such big ideas and big concepts, the actual process of like getting the sieve out and distilling that down into a bit of text that just hits the point you're trying to make. What's that like for you as an academic? Is it an easy process, or is it difficult second album vibes? Is it hard?
It's an impossible process. And that's the beginning and not the end of the process. For me, I've struggled with these a lot. I tend to think big picture. That's where I thrive. That's where the juices sort of get moving in my brain, like intellectually and creatively. But what I found is that the most productive, the most useful or concrete things that I've ever thought or written always go through the body. Like that's my anchor. And that can sound a little bit abstract, but I don't think I've ever written anything true that I haven't felt in my body first. And I'm very interested in that because I think we've been very, especially in academia, but you know, in the zeitgeist writ large, we think that knowing is a thing of memorizing and words and learning through maybe even conversation. And I think knowing can take different forms. I think there's a knowing that the body and the senses can only take us to. And it is impossible to write that. It's by definition, you know, it's wordless, but I like to live in this intersection of, or this little threshold maybe of what can and cannot be said. And it is an impossible task, really. I mean, yes, we'll see. We'll see.
I have
how
faith.
It goes writing my dissertation, but
I have faith in you. I have faith in you. I believe you will do it. Like, and because it's not a world I have direct experience of, but just hearing you articulate that thing, the difference between learning and knowing, that just sort of like immediately set a firework off in my brain, because so many people who may not be in academia will definitely have experience of the kind of traditional educational system of like learning by rote and kind of learning by drilling down and repetition in order to understand a subject, but actually knowing a subject and knowing something at almost at a spiritual kind of like level is much, much different. And it sounds like a very difficult task indeed. I'm curious with the things that you're kind of exploring with running, like, is there anything in the immediate that you're finding, like in your kind of daily practice, are there things you're noticing like on runs you've done, I don't know, yesterday or over the weekend, maybe over some turkey trots that you were part of over Thanksgiving? Are there things that you pick up on? I'm always interested in the idea of like minutiae and detail. Like, are there like little things that sort of set off chains of thought in your mind when it comes to running?
I don't know about little things, although I love that question and I might text you about it a few days from now. But there is one thing that your question prompted me to say out loud. I've had this thought in the last couple of weeks, and it is that I think more and more, and I don't know if this is just a New York thing or rest of the world thing as well, you can never be sure when you live in New York, because New York has this like insulating effect where you think that what happens here is what happens everywhere else. And I like, I'm not a fan of that, but I'm a victim of it too. So I don't know if it's just a New York thing or rest of the world thing, but I think there's a lot of runners asking that question of what's our responsibility to the world and how can we as runners reach out and make a difference. I don't know, maybe because I'm semi-new to the scene, maybe this has been going on forever, but I don't think so. I think there is something about this moment that speaks of how much we are realizing that we're implicated in all the geopolitical global dynamics that go on. Of course, like right now I'm talking about the war in Gaza, but I think generally speaking, runners are creatively coming up with ways to leverage what we do and what we love doing to impact our communities. There's been a lot of support from runners groups for the war in Gaza, or just like disability, or yeah, that's something that I've noticed in New York. Certainly, that I noticed during the marathon. And I don't know, that gives me a kind of, I don't know if hope is the word, but in some ways that's what I was trying to do with my film. And I think since then I've moved a little bit away from political activism through sports, but now it just seems like that's where the tide is going, and that I love that, because I do think we have something to contribute. I don't know, like I've just noticed that people are less reluctant to engage with political questions in the running scene maybe than before. And I don't think this is just a now moment. I think this has been building up to now, but
I think that's a really interesting point. And I would tend to agree. And I wouldn't say that it was just something that is just contained within New York. I feel like I can only speak for London, really. But it feels like that is happening over here as well. And I think the key word is leverage. I think of people actually using, I feel like community and running has always been a thing. But like that thing of actually having collective power and the feeling of responsibility in order to leverage a group of individuals that come together for a certain time to do a certain thing, to actually put that kind of collective energy as well as into your training, into doing some good, be it for the local area or for youth development or for, you know, political activism or protest or whatever the thing is. And I think because running's visibility has seemingly exponentially kind of grown from my perspective in a relatively short Right. space of time, it feels like the channels are casting an even wider net to kind of grab people's attention to whatever the issue is. So I feel like, no, I think you're absolutely right there. And I think the more kind of creative individuals kind of get sort of swept up into the space as well, there's just different means to tell those stories as well and communicate, be it through documentaries or audio or films or photography or like events or art experiences, installations, academic writing, like you name it. And I think that's, you know, super heartening. And it's also really, really kind of thrilling to be sort of bearing witness to it and to be speaking to individuals, you know, such as yourself, about their kind of perspective on it. I'd love to bring it back though to this thing we call running, this thing that we both love. I mean, for you right now, is there post New York? I know you were still sort of like processing it, but are you considering another dance? I mean, there's always London in April. We'd love to have you. We'd love to have you. I can't get you a place, by the way. That is not an offer of a place. I have no power in that. I can't get you a bib.
Yeah, you know, weirdly enough, ever since the New York City Marathon, well, for 2 weeks, I didn't think about bibs at all. I'm, to begin with, not big into racing, or I wasn't. I guess can't say that anymore. Yeah, strangely enough, I've been more and more excited about doing trail races. And I say strangely, all the races I've done before were trail races, which were like four of them, maybe, and then the Sahara Marathon. But it's strange and it's not strange. I think I found a deeper, a new gear in the New York City Marathon that I didn't know I had.
Okay.
And I very much enjoyed the experience of explosivity, the explosiveness of my legs during the last couple miles. Yeah, took me by surprise. And man, did I love that feeling. It just felt like a call from the wild, like mile 21, are you ready to crank it up? Yes. But also it showed me a different or another depth of my endurance capacities that I would love to explore a little bit more. And I think races between 21 and 42K on the trail with, you know, like a good spicy elevation profile could be places for me to thrive and to get that call again. And see how we respond this time, kind of thing. So yeah, I'm thinking about maybe spring. There's a Golden Trail Series race upstate New York called Breakneck Ridge or Breakneck Trail Run, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
which has both 21 and 42K distances, perhaps others, that I went and saw last year. A bunch of my friends ran it. And I think that would be a very cool race to sort of experiment with, like faster segments, right? Doesn't have a lot of flat segments, but nonetheless. So there's that. There's also this last October, I competed in the Salomon Ultra Pyrenu race in 21K capacity. And that one was super exciting because it starts with a 2 or 3K negative incline,
mm-hmm.
And the top 10 women in that race ran those splits like track athletes, bro. Like, these people are insane, I swear. And then, like, there's like a 800 meter climb or something like that. Not 800, but like maybe 500 in the following 5K. It's like, can legs really do that? And I think seeing what I was capable of, or what, you know, happened during the New York City Marathon, got me excited about, like, okay, so I think I have a lot of gears in my legs, even after, you know, 3 hours of running. So how could I take that to the trail? So, yeah, I'm thinking about that. I think rote running can improve a trail runner's capacities and skill set a lot in ways that are not necessarily being explored a lot. So I think I want to experiment with that a little bit, like do speed on flat as well as trail training, and kind of take both to the mountains. I don't know. We'll see.
You're not signing up to anything right now. Don't worry, I'm not holding out a race registration form, but I know a few people who ran New York, and they definitely didn't talk about having explosivity in their legs north of mile 21. So that's an exciting prospect, like, yeah, to be sort of sitting on something and feeling like I've got more, like I can crank it up a gear. Like, that's got to be quite a thrilling feeling to be sort of sitting on.
Yeah, and I just want more of that. I mean, that's taking this form right now for me, but like it will probably change from now to the spring. I think I'm more invested in how to get that feeling again. And we'll see what that looks like. But
Watch out on the trails.
Watch out on the trails. That said, I want to win all these races.
There's the competitive, there's the basketball player coming out. I love it. And I've loved this conversation, and I've loved your perspective. And I feel like we can't quite do justice to your perspective and wonderful kind of lens on running in a kind of hour long kind of podcast episode. So I would really encourage people to go and follow you on Instagram. And I know there's links to some of the stuff that you've written, and obviously the Running Home film as well. But just to go back to something we sort of began on, this idea of the beginner's mindset. For people listening who maybe sort of registered with that idea, I certainly did when you were articulating it. Is there any advice that you can give to people listening who are maybe thinking, oh, I'd love to have that beginner's mindset, maybe with running, maybe with their own kind of movement, kind of modality that they're exploring? Is there anything that you always kind of come back to that helps you stay in that perspective of the beginner's mindset?
This is not advice to people. This is just what helps me. I continue to go swim laps twice a week, and I am so bad. I am grandmas swim faster than me, like grandmas and their friends on the other lane next to me. They're like cranking it up, and I'm just like, oh. And I love that for many reasons. One of them being that I know swimming will be something that I do for the rest of my life. And I don't know that I feel that way about running. But I also, it really keeps me like going into a place where I know I'm not, you know, moving at my prime. And that's at the very least humbling. Whenever I've, you know, dealt with small injuries or tapering and stuff, and I run less and I go more to the pool, and I just get to tap into this side of me and of the world of sports that like, I'm super average, like below average, really. Yeah, maybe that helps. Maybe it doesn't. I'm not sure. But yeah, I don't know. That's when I feel the most like a beginner, and I try to embrace that.
I love that. No, I love that. And I think you're right. Like it's your what works for you. And like you say, it's not advice, but I think there's great kind of wisdom to be taken from putting yourself in positions to be humbled and to be reminded that there's still room to grow. And I feel like I've grown just hearing your kind of story and perspective from this conversation. And that feels like a good point to end this conversation on, because yeah, it's just been fantastic. And I want to end on a high. I feel like I want to go to the swimming pool, taste that chlorine and be humbled and take that into my running as well. But Imma, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I urge people to go and check out your writing and the Running Home film. But thank you for coming on and being such a brilliant guest on The Big Run.
Oh, of course. Thank you for having me. This has been so fun. Your questions are, this has been great. It's been fun. And yeah, I look forward to going on a run with you in person sometime. Got to make that happen. We'll see how or when, but if you ever come to New York, definitely let me know.
That is a verbal contract, listeners. That is a verbal contract. Likewise, London will welcome you with open arms if you ever find yourself this side of the Atlantic. But yeah, thank you so much, Imma. I really enjoyed it. A big thank you to Imma. Check out Imma's newsletter. Her Substack link is included in today's show notes. Share Location is a fantastic read. I urge you to subscribe to that newsletter. You can also watch the film we discussed as well. I'll put a link to the Vimeo in today's show notes as well. Thank you so much to Imma for coming on the show and to you all for tuning in to this episode. I hope you are enjoying the podcast. Please do leave us a review from wherever you listen to the show. It really helps with the show's visibility. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time on The Big Run.